KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from San Francisco and I live in Berkeley.
Off Piedmont Avenue.
I was born in Costa Rica.
Coming up, what's different about this year's election for who leads BART?
It's shaping up to be not just about transit, but also about housing.
Then a new study shows Black men are more likely to get flu shots and diabetes screenings if the doctor seeing them is Black.
So we felt that there was something going on in terms of the communication that was happening during the patient-physician encounter.
And we meet a young Chicano band that's defying genres.
We're kind of just doing our Bay thing up here, taking music that we grew up listening to, the Cuban music, the Latin rock and Latin soul, kind of just making something new with it.
Bay Area flavor. Cross Currents is next. The fight over housing in the Bay Area, who should build it and where it should be built, has turned up in a surprising place. The elections for the board of directors of BART. Four seats on that board are contested in the upcoming November election. KALW's transportation reporter Eli Wertschafter says BART's elections this year are about whether the agency should build more housing near its stations or stay focused on running the trains on time. Eli's with me here in studio. Hey, Eli.
Hey, Hannah. Are you ready to hear about the elections for the BART board of directors?
Sure.
You don't sound that enthusiastic. I'm guessing this is something you don't usually pay a lot of attention to, the BART board race. Am I right?
Not a whole lot.
Okay, well, by the end of this conversation, I am going to make you care.
Okay.
Okay? That's my challenge.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Let's go. What do you want to know?
So the basics first. What is the BART board? What do they even do?
Okay, BART board. These are the people who run BART. You can basically think of BART as being like a company with a general manager who reports to the board of the directors, except in this case that the board of directors are elected by we the people.
Okay. So then how does it work? Is there like a director elected from each city that BART goes through?
Oh, if only it were that simple. No, it is super weird.
Uh-huh.
There are 9 different BART districts, each one representing a couple of stations in the areas kind of around that station.
Mm.
But it doesn't always line up with cities, and some of the districts are shaped in odd ways. Honestly, I don't know the history of why, but basically, the point is there are 9 districts and 4 of them have contested races for BART directors this year.
Okay, so where are those races?
Okay, like I said, the district boundaries are really hard to describe, but you might have a BART candidate on your ballot if you live in San Francisco, Oakland, Antioch, Pittsburgh, Concord, Alameda, San Leandro, Fremont, Union City, Newark, or Hayward.
Okay, that's a lot of places.
A lot of places.
But say you're like me, I live in Union City. I get to vote in this election, mm-hmm. but I'm not a regular BART rider. Why should I care about this race?
Well, your tax dollars help pay for BART, and your car is stuck on the road with other people who decided that BART is not for them that day for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
But besides that, this year's race is unusual and important because it's shaping up to be not just about transit, but also about housing.
Why housing?
Because we're in the Bay Area. Everything is about housing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but more specifically, this year there's a new and controversial law in California that lets BART override local zoning rules to build on the properties that it owns near BART stations.
Mm. Okay, controversy. Now you have my interest.
So this law, this was put forward by Assemblymember David Chu from San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And his idea was, we need more housing, and where we need it most is by transit centers, so people don't have to drive as far and pollute as much.
Mm-hmm.
That law gives BART the power to build higher and more densely on its property than the local rules might otherwise allow.
Mm-hmm.
It also requires that some of that housing be affordable. So for a lot of housing advocates and environmentalists, the law is a good thing, but other people see it as BART making a power grab, giving the runaround to city governments, to local control, to potentially build higher or more densely than the people living in that city actually want.
So what kind of impact, though, does this have? Because I guess the question is, how much property does BART really have to build on? It doesn't seem like it's a lot.
Maybe more than you think. BART owns 250 acres of land that the agency says could be developed, mostly on existing parking lots.
Uh-huh.
And that's not counting the land that BART has already redeveloped or is planning on developing.
So what's an example of a place that BART has already done that kind of redevelopment?
Probably the best example is the Fruitvale Transit Village near the Fruitvale Station.
Yes,
you know that place?
I do.
That's kind of their...
It has like a farmer's market too.
Exactly. It has a farmer's market, this plaza. There's housing, retail, offices, even a charter school on the site. And a parking garage was built next to it to replace lost parking.
Mm-hmm.
BART's done a lot of this kind of development in recent years. Most of it not as glamorous as the Fruitvale Transit Village. Maybe it's just apartments or something. But all that development is becoming an important funding source for BART because they can attract money from developers to improve the stations. And then they also attract new riders to the system when they build housing and commercial stuff near the stations.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets BART into this kind of new territory of being not just a transit agency, but also a regional urban planning agency.
Yeah.
So now in the BART board elections, the battle lines are generally between two camps. You have one group of candidates, a lot of whom have backgrounds in urban planning,
mm-hmm.
who want BART to build lots of new housing and other developments. And then there's this other group that wants BART to focus on kind of the bread and butter BART issues like safety, cleanliness, making the trains run on time.
Okay, so let's talk about those candidates. Who are the candidates and which side are they on?
Okay, so you've got four races, starting with District 8, that's in San Francisco. You have four front runners. Janice Lee is endorsed by the housing group Yimby Action, and she's really a proponent of using the new law for BART to build affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
Another candidate, Melanie Nutter, has an urban planning background, and she also wants to make development a priority.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan Lyons, who works in city government, he's more in the middle. He wants to build housing, but it's not one of his top priorities. And then on the anti-development side is Eva Chow, who says BART is suffering from what she calls mission drift by building all this housing instead of focusing on riders.
Okay, so those candidates are all in San Francisco?
Right. That's the busiest race for the BART district that takes up much of San Francisco.
Okay, what about elsewhere?
You've got BART District 6. That includes Fremont and Union City, where you live.
Yes.
Anu Natarajan there is the more pro-development candidate.
Mm-hmm.
She wants to make sure that local governments support any BART building projects. And on the other side, you have Liz Ames, a civil engineer who says it's not BART's job to build housing.
Mm-hmm.
In District 2, that's in North Contra Costa County, the incumbent, Joel Keller, he opposed the new law that gives BART the power to sidestep local rules. He's being challenged by Mark Foley, who supports the law to build more.
Okay.
And then finally, you've got District 4, centered in Oakland. And there, it's the opposite situation. The incumbent, Robert Rayburn, enthusiastically supports the new law. And his challenger, Paul Cummings, says BART should get back to the basics of safety, cleanliness, and financial sustainability.
And not building up housing.
Not exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's a lot of names, but we'll put links to everyone's campaigns on our website.
So in every race you just talked about, there's a candidate who's into building more housing near BART, and there's a candidate also who thinks that shouldn't be BART's focus. And so, like, do we have to choose? Can't BART be safe, clean, reliable, and at the same time building housing?
Well, I think all these candidates say they want a clean, safe, reliable system on both sides. It's just that some of them also have this other priority, and the others think that priority is a distraction that takes away from the needs of riders.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a question of what kind of agency BART should be. Is BART just a transit agency, or should it be a regional planning agency that's thinking not just about transportation, but about urban design and housing? And because of this new law that passed, the BART directors have more power than ever to determine which of those ways they go.
Right. It's a dilemma. It's interesting because it feels like we are in a unique situation in the San Francisco Bay Area with housing.
Everything's about housing.
Everything's
it's
about
very
housing,
much
like
entwined
you said,
with
so.
Transportation.
All right.
So, I don't know. Did I convince you, Hannah, to care maybe just a little bit about BART elections? Be honest.
I care, Eli.
Yes. Okay, you're going to go home and read up on your candidates in Union
I
City?
I will, Eli.
Great. Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you. Eli Wirtschafter is KLW's transportation reporter. Find links to the candidates' web pages at our website, klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. A new clinical trial by the National Bureau of Economic Research studied 1,300 black men in Oakland to see if race was a factor in determining whether they sought preventative care services like flu shots or diabetes screenings. The study found they were more likely to get them if they were initially seen by a black doctor as opposed to a non-black doctor. And they were also more likely to talk with black doctors about other health problems. Owen Garrick co-wrote the study. He's president and CEO of Bridge Clinical Research, an Oakland-based organization that helps clinical researchers find patients from targeted ethnic groups. He joined me in studio, and I asked first, how did he recruit 1,300 black men in Oakland?
If you're a black guy, you have hair. You pretty much go to the black barbershop to get your hair cut. So there was a great swath of income classes, educational classes, lots of black men visiting black barbershops. So we felt we could get a great sample, a good representative sample of black men in this one area called the black barbershop.
And you just went in to barbershops?
So great question. See, we just showed up. Would say, hey, you know, this is who we are. We're interested in doing a research study on improving healthcare for black men. Would you be interested? Mm-hmm. And overwhelmingly, they would say, yeah, why not? And we used all male physicians, both black and non-black. And subjects at the barbershops, they filled out these demographic background surveys, age. They were all black men. And if they had any chronic conditions, if they were dealing with an illness. So we wanted to figure out what would actually get them there. If you were very sick, didn't have insurance, and someone shows up and gives you access to health care, will you actually go and use some of the services? So
we're talking about free services.
Free services. In fact, we incentivized them financially. So you were paid to show up. So if you didn't have a car, the field staff would call you an Uber and get you from the barbershop to the clinic and get you back from the clinic to the barbershop.
So that cost is not an issue.
Yeah. So we tried to minimize everything. And I'll talk about the preventative services they could take or decide to take once they came to the clinic. They were all related to cardiovascular disease. So blood pressure and BMI, body mass index. Mm-hmm. The more invasive ones involved giving blood. So you can give blood, it was a finger prick or stick, and you can get your diabetes checked. Then you had another finger stick for your cholesterol, how high your cholesterol was. And then we offered the flu shot. So we had a two-step process. Once you came into the clinic, you were given, as a research subject, a tablet. And it showed a picture of your doctor, and that doctor was either black or non-black. And then you chose which services you wanted to take out of those five that I mentioned. Your doctor then comes into the room, into the exam room, and we directed all the physicians that your job, if they took no services, was to get them to take all the preventative services.
So the tablet, I get my tablet.
Yes.
It has already a picture of the doctor who will treat me?
So, yes.
Or
so
do I get to choose? Is that what
you don't
saying?
Get to choose. Okay. You are randomized as a patient as to which doctor you're going to see.
Got it.
So what we found was that there was really no difference in the number of services you took just by looking at the picture.
Okay.
So if you get a black doctor versus a non-black doctor, on average, you chose the same number of services, whether they were, as I described, non-invasive or invasive. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is, once the physicians came in, the black doctors were able to push and increase the percentage of services these black male patients took. So, and I'll give you a few examples. So in terms of blood pressure, there was a 15% increase in the amount of people that would agree to have their blood pressure recorded. Mm. In terms of BMI, there was a 27% increase just with this interaction with the black physician compared to the non-black physician. And when we jump to the invasive services, so if we look at diabetes screening, a 47% increase in those subjects that were willing to have their be screened for diabetes. When we look at cholesterol, a 76% increase.
That's huge.
Those were dramatic. We did not expect anything like that. And then similarly with flu vaccine, you had a 56% increase.
Still big.
Still big. So mm-hmm. these are gigantic, and they are medically meaningful. So we tried to think about, well, what's the rationale for this? So we felt that there was something going on in terms of the communication that was happening during the patient-physician encounter. And that belief was also enforced because the doctors were able to write notes. Mm-hmm. The Black doctors wrote many more notes about their engagement and their interaction compared to the non-Black doctors. Mm-hmm. And there were things about, his kids getting older, going to high school. They were non-medical notes. So there's more information being exchanged in that interaction.
Sounds like there was a conversation.
Yes, there were conversations.
A non-medical conversation
absolutely.
Happening.
And that we felt reduced any mistrust barriers. Mm-hmm. And so once the research subjects or patients were comfortable, they were willing to listen to the message around diabetes prevention, flu, BMI, and were more willing to uptake those services compared to their interactions with the non-Black doctors.
So what you take these results, what do these results then mean for you and
right.
your study?
From a policy perspective, it shows what, empirically, the value of diversity in healthcare. So,
because that was the main question,
absolutely,
of your study.
Right.
It's actually called "Does Diversity Matter for Health?"
Absolutely,
and the answer is
yes,
it does.
And we can quantify the impact, and then we feel that the impact is largely due to communication. Mm. And we saw that there was this increase in, especially, invasive healthcare services.
What solutions do you
sure.
see, or what's next?
Right. There is, how do you counteract discrimination? How do you impact policy and regulations? How do you increase just the volume of potential pre-meds, pre-health students that can go through this pipeline and be available to become clinicians of color? This is a mission for me, right? But I also believe in figuring out how you really impact the change. And I think it's really figuring out what are those 2-3 levers you can pull. Because oftentimes, we think, oh, there are these 85 things we need to do and we can solve the problem. You just can't do 85 things, right? You can do 2 or 3 things really, really well. And let's in life, that's some of my life philosophy. In life, let's figure out how to do that.
Owen Garrick is president and CEO of Bridge Clinical Research. You can find a link to that study at our website. That's also where you can subscribe to the Cross Currents newsletter. Do it at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. We've talked context and connection. Let's hear some culture. There's an eclectic Chicano band here in the Bay Area that can't quite be defined by genre, and that's where the group gets its name.
Gilberto Rodriguez y Los Intocables, which means The Untouchables. The band recently dropped a tropical-themed album called Sabor Maracuya Desnuda, meaning sweetness of naked passion fruit. It's an ode to Bay Area-style rumba, inviting listeners to get out and jam in the streets. Band leader Daniel Rodriguez and pianist Ruben Sandoval came to KELW to talk about their musical influences for the album and what it means to make joyful music in the era of Trump.
Everywhere you go, it's like you don't feel flavor, you don't feel love, you don't see people as they're walking down the street. You know, everyone's plugged in, dialed up. My name is Daniel Rodriguez. I'm part of Intocables. You know, go to the park and you don't see, you know, music anymore, or you got the police coming down on you. Why do you have the speaker? And it's like taking steps back in our freedom of expression, but it's also a futuristic time. You know, there's a lot of different ways to get out there and do things. So we're really like at a crossroads and we just got to express ourselves.
I'm Ruben Sandoval. I play keys on the album. I started playing in elementary school. My elementary school had a music program, and it was really my father who pushed me to play music. He was a musician, piano and congas. So, and my sister sang too, and also played piano, so I was kind of always surrounded by music. So that's kind of, I just kind of came up in a musical environment. So when it was kind of like my turn to kind of come into it, you know, took to it, and yeah, I've been playing ever since.
I grew up on the border, outside of San Diego, Baja California. You know, we had the old back house where my dad would have the record player. You know, pops listening to John Lee Hooker, you know, Los Mocedades or Silvio Rodriguez. You know, they had a lot of old Cuban records that were pressed in Mexico that were from the Cultural Revolution. And just, you know, seeing those covers and then listening to that music, that just, that changed me for sure.
Yeah, Cuban music is really popular with Mexicans. Mambo took off in Mexico and continues to this day, you know. There's been a really long history of Cuban music, and we've been able to learn it from the source.
Armando Peraza.
Yeah, Francisco Agua Vega. Those are the guys that came from Cuba back in the day, and everyone like learned from them.
It's something that came before us, like we were saying, you know, all these masters, you know, what a privilege to be in connection to that and to be able to be that next step.
I would say almost like a revival of kind of like traditional music meets the new vibe and flair of kind of the young people playing music these days. Guamaco is a rhythm and a style of the Cuban music rumba. It involves three conga players, among other musicians, playing clave. There's the quinto, which is the one on top, the highest pitched drum in response to the dancers and the singing. There's the conga, or the segundo, or segunda. It's playing opposite the clave. It's kind of calling and responding with it. And then there is the tumbadora, which is the biggest and lowest pitched drum. the thing to do back in the day was to get your congas and like go jam in Dolores Park, right? And like have rumbas and stuff. So it's really like ingrained in the San Francisco culture. I think it's just pretty interesting how we improvised the whole album, pretty much, right?
Yeah.
It was mostly improvised. I'd say like 95%, 90%.
I would say so.
So what you're hearing is just a snapshot of young Latinos and their whole experience captured in the studio. If you can relate to that, then chévere, because that's what we are.
For the album, we had to really listen into the different influences that we had. So the music that we produced, we have traces of indigenous music, of African music, a lot of different roots that, you know, we pay homage to.
Good town music. Yeah.
We kind of just doing our Bay thing up here, taking music that we grew up listening to, the Cuban music, the Latin rock and Latin soul, Santana, Malo, War, and kind of just making something new with it.
We're taking the torch because, you know, the OGs aren't getting any younger. Driving through the streets in Oakland, driving through the streets in San Francisco, it's like, damn, everyone's one step away from being on the street, being locked up. Our raza out there in detention centers.
Yeah, this is the most important time to play music that reflects our heritage and culture and where we come from.
And how we process all this crazy stuff that's happening in the world right now. It's something for our people to feel good and to feel proud of themselves. And I think in making music, we're really doing that. We're just giving that love back.
You can hear Gilberto Rodriguez y Los Intocables play tomorrow at the Legionnaire Saloon in Oakland. Check out KALW.org for more details. And while you're there, why not subscribe to the podcast? This edition of Bay Area Beats was produced by Marisol Medina Cadena. Today's Cross Currents team also includes Janae Darden, Nina Gensler-Debs, Sarah Coast, Angela Johnston, Kristen McCandless, True Quinn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Porfirio Rangel, Josh Wilson, and Lisa Wang. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer, and news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by experimental composer Madeline Murky from San Francisco. She'll perform her pieces at The Laundry in San Francisco tomorrow night as part of the Soundwave Festival. Show starts at 6 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.